Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten at the University of Missouri, still at Mizzou. My guests are folks who used to be at the University of Missouri. Zandra DiRajo is now at the University of Florida working with the Lastinger Center. So Zandra, great to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Do you know the number of times that I've said I'm still at Missouri? It just won't leave. But yes, at Florida. Welcome.
And luckily, we can still collaborate in lots of ways, you know, even though you're over there and can still talk in this way, too. But we are also joined by our mutual friend and colleague, Aaron Smith, who's from the University of Southern Mississippi. Aaron, thanks so much for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Aaron did her PhD program at Mizzou. And I wonder if you want to just say real briefly a little bit about your time here or your dissertation or anything that are fond remembrances.
Yeah, I loved my time at Mizzou. I learned so much. Got to work with such amazing people, had a really profound impact on my career and personal life. So now I am at the University of Southern Mississippi, and my work has shifted a little bit from my dissertation, which is looking at pedagogical practices of a monolingual teacher who is working with multilingual learners. And now my work continues to shift and morph as I think about the context with which I work in.
Yeah, and that's perfect. Like your interest in multilingual learners is something that's shared with Zandra. Zandra's been doing work for a long time about supporting multilingual learners in mathematics contexts. And that's also the article that we're going to be talking about today is in that realm. This is just recently published in Educational Studies in Mathematics. Woo-hoo! And the article is entitled Examining English Language Learners' Learning Needs Through the Lens of Algebra Curriculum Materials. And that's by Zandra and Aaron. And you've both, like I said, been interested in supporting multilingual learners in math. And first, let's just touch base on what terms we're using here, like multilingual learners, English language learners, English learners. Help us set the stage for that before we have our conversation.
So I use English learners. I still use English learners. There's a lot of, you know, discussion in the field. I think we have, we being myself, and some other colleagues have a commentary coming out in response to responses to the hashtag retire ELL thing that Jarst had a whole range of papers on. But I prefer the term English learner for several reasons. First of which is that I am speaking about students who are learning English specifically in my work, not students that are learning other languages, not bilingual students that are already completely fluent, although you don't have to be labeled bilingual. Emergent bilingual is also another term that people use, but I really am talking about US students in my own work who are labeled by schools as English learners. That's one way for practitioners to find work is by labeling it in the way that they're labeled in schools, which is not always the best argument, right? Because there's a lot of deficit language, and I appreciate that stance as well. But in the US in particular, there's a lot of intersections between that label and race and marginalization that exist that don't exist for students that are, for example, not native English speakers, but come over because they're, you know, sons or daughters of diplomats or professors, things like that. So I am speaking or writing about very specific population of students that have been horribly underserved in our schools.
Yeah, I would agree with what Zandra was saying. In some of the work that I do, I have tried to use the term multilingual learner more of late as a way to just be more expansive in who it is that I'm talking about. So sometimes some of the work that I do isn't just contextualized to the United States. It has implications outside of the US. So I try to, like, in that way, help readers find, like, even though maybe this is related to students who were learning English as the language of instruction in this context, the ideas can still relate to other students, other multilingual learners.
Mm-hmm. And for this particular article, it does have English language learners as the sort of term that's used. And can you just tell us about how that decision came?
We had a lot of discussion about the terminology we would use in the paper and ultimately decided to use English language learners because that's the language the textbooks used. And since we are analyzing those supports, and the supplemental activities, we thought it was appropriate to use that terminology in the paper since we were analyzing the curriculum.
Yeah. So now we can take your interests and we're focusing it now at this analysis of curriculum materials and algebra materials. And so I'm just curious, what was it that kind of spurred on this particular study and doing this analysis of the curriculum resources?
Do I remember?
I remember. Do you remember?
I don't at all.
Oh,
I remember. I remember the Cambio Center funding that initially took some of this out. That's it.
I got this. So I don't remember which year it was in my doctoral program, but there was a time that I vividly remember I was sitting in Xander's office and we were talking about teaching multilingual learners or teaching English language learners. And in through that conversation, something came up about related to curriculum and opportunities. And we were sitting there and she had some curriculum on her bookshelf and we pulled it off and started looking at like how
the support out,
what the instructional supports were for teachers in the textbooks. And she pulled off an algebra one, in fact. And we flipped to the chat. We were both looking through textbooks and she found this one about talking about graphs, about minimum and maximum, and how the teacher was to help students understand what minimum was and what maximum was, and tried to connect to a real life experience. But the real life experience in this textbook was minimum as related to minimum wage and maximum as related to a maximum security prison. And we were like, oh my gosh, what? This is not good. And this is, you know, for ELLs that, and this is the kind of language that's being communicated to the teacher and then through the students. And that kind of just like spurred this work.
Oh my God. I am so glad that you remembered that because I totally forgot that, but I still remember the little call out box and it's in a book I'm looking on a shelf, but it's in a book and it was a call out and it said for your English learners. And it exactly had that. And we were like, whoa, like, are they still that bad? The textbooks? I think that was like kind of our interest because it was a textbook I used to teach out of as a high school teacher.
So that would definitely, you know, pique an interest to take a deeper look, a more systematic look at those curriculum materials and supports for English learners. But then what was some of the literature that you drew on that sort of helped you have a frame of reference for looking at those materials?
We've both been doing this work for a while, but I think one of the things that came up that was really nice was that Aaron and I, along with Jiang Yi at Iowa State, who was also a grad student at Missouri with us, and was Matt Sackow maybe on that paper also? We had a ZDM piece come out that was like years in the making, and it was in a special issue that recently came out. And there was a really nice survey paper in there by a bunch of folks. It was Judith Moscovich, Kirsten Areth. I'm going to say names wrong because I haven't met some of these folks in person, but I love their work and I've communicated via email. Jenny Ingram and Suzanne Prediger. Protege, I don't know, but I love her work very much. And they wrote this lovely survey paper that really did a nice job of bringing together the research landscape in math ed related to multilingual students. And they had some design principles for instructional materials and things like that. So that brought together a way to frame some of this and pointed us to some further resources. But then we also hit on some of the classics that you would imagine, like cognitive demand and things like that. But again, connected back to a lot of work that people have been doing for a long time around multilingual learners. Judith in particular has done so much to put forth some frameworks and ways of thinking about this work.
I think the other thing that stands out in my mind is just the body of literature around curriculum and teachers' use of curriculum and the importance of curriculum in determining student learning opportunities.
So, all right, with that in mind, and then you wanted to take a look at multiple textbooks, these multiple curriculum programs. So how did you select those? And then what was the sort of the rough version of the process that you went through to go to analyze them?
One of the things or one of the goals that we had was that we wanted to kind of cast a large net over algebra curriculum. So we would have a good sense of how language learners in the U.S. in an Algebra 1 classroom were experiencing Algebra 1. And so in our decision, our selection process for the curriculum was to find those that had the largest market share. So I think collectively, we had like 70 something percent of high school and 80% of middle school curriculum. And so that kind of like really gave us a sense of like, this is what the majority of language learners in the United States are experiencing in their classrooms, potentially.
Yeah. And I think that's some of the reason why you don't see a lot of the NSF or any of the NSF funded curricula represented in this. I will say it might have been a somewhat different outcome if we had included, you know, some more reform oriented curricula. But this was, as Aaron said, the largest share of the market in terms of Algebra 1 commercial textbooks.
Yeah, and you're trying to understand what is there, what is in front of the teachers who are teaching most of the students. You're not trying to understand, like, what are the possibilities? What are the range of, you know, ways that it's going to, you're sort of like, if ELLs are in algebra, what's the thing they're most likely experiencing or that their teacher is seeing?
Right. So then after we had selected the textbooks, we looked at the student-facing materials, we looked at the supplemental activities, so those that were flagged for ELLs in the curriculum. We looked at the instructional notes that had also like some kind of notation on them. Most of it's like an icon or something. And then any kind of like front matter that was related to that as well.
Yeah. And those are the things that I remember as a teacher being on adoption committees and then also just having these big boxes of books from Glencoe or whoever was my textbook publisher. And it had all these supplements. And so it was a lot of those things that teachers likely had access to at some point. And we're not saying that they use them. We're not saying that they still had them because a lot of them are like a really thin paper that I kind of lost over time. But we're saying these are the resources that the publisher produced in order to support, I use that word in quotes, teachers in instruction with English learners.
All right, great. So let's go ahead and move into what you found when you looked at these curriculum resources. And the paper, you sort of identify three major sort of themes in your findings. And I was wondering if you could just sort of take us through what were those bigger ideas that sort of came out as you took the systematic look across the books and the resources.
Okay, so we do have three implied needs. And I think they're not surprising in and of themselves. I think, and I'll go through them with Aaron, but the surprising thing is that when you look at them and you look at curriculum and thinking about curriculum sending these messages, that's more of the interesting thing and how these unintended messages occur in our day-to-day and we have to uncover them. So the first implied need I think we came up with was that all students require the same accommodations. All English learner students or students labeled as English learners need the same accommodations. And so what really highlighted this, and hopefully you'll read the paper and get to see too, but there was no discussion really in any of these materials about levels of English proficiency around different skills. So you might be I know as a Portuguese learner, my reading and my writing are not the same level, nor is my speaking or listening. I have different levels in all of those different things, listening being the highest because I grew up in households that spoke Portuguese. But these materials treat all students as though they all need the same language resources and things like that, which we know isn't true. We know that students have different strengths that we should draw on, even if they're all in the process of acquiring English.
And it also seems like another way that English learners would be very different is like they also might be coming from different native languages, right? Like I am not an expert in this area, but to me, it would seem very different if you have some Asian students that have immigrated to the United States and that are trying to learn English from that background. And then some Spanish speakers, you know, who are in a kind of Latin-based language, but that's just all flattened, right? It's all just the curriculum just views it as one group of students and here's the tip or here's the strategy for them.
A little more nuanced, I would say, than that. So I would say broadly speaking about English language acquisition, students were treated the same. So, you know, building off what Xander was saying, like there was an attention to like different stages of language acquisition. So like we have from WIDA has it really broken down into different levels. There wasn't any attention to that. There was some attention to students like a first language or an additional language. So the one that we saw the most was Spanish, which makes sense considering like the demographics of the United States where these books are being marketed to. And if I recall correctly, I do think there were some supplemental, a CD or things that you could access online that were for other languages, but they were not readily available. So like some of the Spanish language references and like drawing on maybe a root word that had some overlap was referenced in like the hardbound book.
Okay, that's helpful. And so some of the support that was provided is just sort of like, this should be helpful for all of your English learners. But then they sometimes had specific cases where they're like this or this or this, depending on background a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. And I will just, hedge a bit also and say that we didn't look at every single activity in every single book. We picked some key chapters that were very important as per, you know, prior studies and stuff, checkpoints or big ideas in Algebra 1. And so there could have been things hidden in there that we missed, but that was, you know, outside the study. We had to limit it somehow.
And then what about the kind of content support? And was that sort of also kind of flattened for the English learners, or what was going on there in terms of the sorts of mathematical supports that they were getting?
I think that leads us to like our second implied need that we had, which was that ELLs require additional remediated practice. And I would say in conjunction with that, there was this message that was being relayed that ELLs are below grade level. So not necessarily at grade level, but below grade level. And in looking across at the materials, like they had different supplemental activities and even problems within the lesson that were flagged as like enrichment activities or challenging tasks. And ELLs were always absent from those. And so sending this message that like an absence of like those kinds of not having access to those problems is also relaying a message about what ELLs are capable of. When we looked across the tasks and compared them, the tasks for ELLs, and then compared those with the student-facing materials, so like what a typical student would see, those tasks for ELLs were predominantly focused on remediation, skills practice. When we used this cognitive demand framework, they were at the lower end of that, and even some that like fell outside of that we couldn't even score. It was like a below a memorization activity, so like a transcription activity where they were literally copying something.
She's absolutely correct. I think the co-labeling, because as a textbook manufacturer, you want to make things easy to find. That totally makes sense. One way we do that is we put labels on things. And I did this as a teacher too, right? Like this is my activities for this group or this kid or whatever. But I think this has made me more cognizant of the fact that the co-labeling that we do does send a message. And that message is of remediation. If you're always tagging English learners with special education students or students who are struggling, and then you also have resources for beyond level or advanced students that are not co-labeled, you are sending a message unintentionally, I think these students are not at grade level or need remediation in content. Now, you could say that maybe the intervention or the struggling part is with the language, but I think that gets washed out because we're in a math classroom. And so that nuanced level of thinking, even if that's the intention, is not there, because, you know, supporting language acquisition is a form of intervention in a lot of places, and they're labeled as such. But I think the bigger issue is that without the nuance of being able to describe that, and there weren't a lot of front matter descriptions describing like all these nuanced ideas about English learners, then you lose that, and it gets distilled down to these labels. And then your brain makes connections, as we hope. You make patterns from things, right? That's a math practice. And those patterns tend to be negative toward perspectives on expectations for and abilities of English learners in mathematics.
Well, I think that also leads into the third implied need that we have, that ELLs require additional vocabulary practice and instruction. So going back to what Sandra was saying about just the messages that they're communicating, and then the lack of guidance on the nuance of language acquisition. So what we found in the textbook is there was this heavy emphasis on learning single terms, learning specific vocabulary outside of mathematical activity, which we know from the research is not effective for supporting language acquisition.
I was just on Twitter, you know, gosh, I go on Twitter probably too much, but I saw somebody that I respect a great deal, and they posted about we have to teach vocabulary, you know, and they're coming from a different philosophical position than I am on learning. I think that I see that differently. I think you can learn a lot of vocabulary and words. Judy talks about, you know, the difference between different perspectives on language use in mathematics, and learning words and their meaning. You can teach that, and you can do it by repetition probably for a lot of kids, and they can know in theory, what the word means with other words, but that's not attaching the meaning that we care about. And that's not going to be the fluency and the understanding that I care about. I think they will perform well. And that's where a lot of the data says that, yes, we have to teach vocabulary. How do we know they're learning it? Because we test them on the vocabulary. So there's a lot that says like, yes, that is going to be effective for teaching in that way. Of course it is, because they're going to know what it means and be able to pick it out on a list or recite it. But I don't really care about that use of words. I want students to have a more meaningful, contextualized, deep understanding of the words in connection to the mathematical ideas. And to do that, I don't think the resources that we came across would give us a good perspective on how to do that as a teacher, because it was done in isolation of the mathematics instead of in conjunction with. And I think that's some of the harm we saw with policies such as in Arizona, when they used to have those English only classes that students had to do if they were labeled English learners, where they had to learn English first before they could progress in mathematics. And I would say that's like, I'm very against that kind of perspective instead of including everyone and trying to like grow together.
I think one other thing I would add to that is we, as a field of mathematics education, we see the value and importance of engaging in mathematical discourse. And we didn't see many opportunities to foster ELL's engagement in mathematical discourse.
To be fair, I didn't see a lot of opportunities otherwise either.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly don't think there was like an emphasis on that with English learners, but I think many of the textbooks, there were some that like did have some of that, but overall, I would say that, yeah, that was not the nature of the textbooks.
But that does kind of lead me to the last question I wanted to ask about the article. As we said before, you did look at what is sort of common based on market share, like of resources and what's presented in these textbooks. But I wanted to ask you just to sort of like, and this can just be your personal speculations or something, but can you imagine, or as you were doing the analysis, did you ever talk about like, man, I wish this would have been like provided for English learners, or I wish this idea would have been incorporated into this lesson? Do you have some of those, you know, pushing the boundary a little bit or just having a little bit more diverse kinds of resources that could have been included?
I struggle with this. I think, you know, I'm biased. I'm going to say something about NCTM. I'm on the board, full disclaimer. But the catalyzing change, you know, I think set us on a good route in terms of like, why do we track and label students, right? And I think that was abundantly clear in this work. I don't know if there's a way in which after we tag students and assign them some label that we can really have equitable instruction in our classrooms. We see it with gifted students where they get pulled out and get treated differently. And that also creates other issues for students that are in the classroom. We see it as we label students as the rabbit group or the turtle group in reading groups. We see it anytime we assign a tag to students. First of all, they're usually not temporary. They tend to, even when we say it's a track, like they can bounce between the tracks. We know that they kind of are not really like that in reality, because you're getting further and further behind or further and further ahead, and disparities just get exacerbated. So I struggle with figuring out if there's a time or a way to do labels in a way that would be beneficial or work toward equitable instruction. I'm not sure it's possible, because I think we're people and we have too many negative stereotypes, and students have too many intersectionalities in their identities that are tied to marginalized groups and things like that, that I think it's problematic. On the flip side, I also understand that there is value in, I'm going to say the word supporting, I don't like that word, but accommodating. You know, it's a thesaurus game over time, but in a way that, like, you know, if you are learning English and you're newer to the U.S. schooling system or just learning, there are some things that we can do specifically to help with language acquisition. But if we just label everybody broadly as English learners and then apply those things, we're oversupplying or undersupplying at various times and not really thinking about the individual child anymore. And so I guess my biggest wish would be that every kid gets labeled as their own unique name and identity. And that's the label we care most about, rather than these supplemental labels, so that I really think about little Zandra and what her strengths are and what her needs are outside of any groups to which she might belong. And I know there's danger in that also, because you wash away inequities and patterns and inequities and things like that. But I think there's a lot of harm perpetrated as we label students. And I'm not sure how to address that, because every accommodation I come up with could be misconstrued or taken in a negative way.
So just for this thought exercise related to the curriculum materials, if you, Zandra, had to actually write an algebra textbook, are you saying that you would try to put in resources and suggestions that would be beneficial to a lot of learners, including to English learners, but you would not label and color code those throughout the pages of the book as English learners' suggestions?
Yeah, I think my current thinking is like it would be tied to an aim.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, if this is what you're looking for, here is a suggestion. But right. The if is more like a learning target, or I want to have a discussion happen or something like that.
Right. Like if I want students to have a good conversation about this topic, this is what I would need to know about those students, or these are questions I could ask and build on. So instead of tagging to, this is like the criticism idea, right? Like you're supposed to criticize ideas and not people. I feel like in education, we tag people or groups of people for intervention rather than thinking about the aim and saying, like, all
we
right,
could
like
have tagged, tag our aim or tag our goal. And then we have some tools to try to reach that goal.
Yeah.
Aaron, do you have any thoughts about, like, as you've looked at all these pages of the curriculum materials, did you have any thoughts of what you wished would have been there, or just other things to try, at least, that might be better?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I wished was there, and I think it was in, like, one of the textbooks, is just a recognition that there are language goals in conjunction with mathematical goals, and those should really be spelled out in the curriculum. And I think this goes back to Sandra's idea about, you know, having this aim. Like, if this is your aim to use language in this way, like, you need to call that out. And then think about ways to support students, all of the students in your class, wherever they are in their various needs, to get reach that goal that you have. You know, I think also, like, I see the tension of, like, curriculum having to sell it at a mass scale. And knowing that in school districts, they label kids, teacher or whoever is on the curriculum committee is looking for the specific things. And I wish there was a different way, but I'm not sure what that would look like.
This is the whole thing, right? We work in huge systems where there's a lot of money injected into the education world. Also, teachers' jobs are really hard and getting harder every day. I don't fault a teacher at all. The reason I got into EL work with mathematics, not only because my parents are immigrants, but also because I remember having a student that came straight from Haiti into my classroom who had yet to, like, be in an English dominant environment. And she was so, like, lovely. I could not communicate well with her because of my ignorance of Creole. And also I had no ways to help her. And I just watched her, like, and I failed her. And I still feel awful about this because, like, what opportunities did she have? I didn't meet her needs. I didn't know how to do. I just gave her naked problems all the time, you know, because I thought that was what I could do. And at the end of the year, she gave me a beautiful present and thanked me for being her teacher. And I felt like the biggest fraud in the whole entire world. And I was like, this is not okay. So, I mean, I don't know. I think, yes, it's very hard to be a teacher. We need better things. We as researchers can start to push that agenda forward. And I hope with papers like this, at least curriculum companies will be like, hey, we could do better. And maybe we can consult with some people for better ideas. But I think we need to start keep pushing in the right direction, maybe.
You know, I also wonder if we should include more across our programs, some, like, a student who is going through a teacher preparation program, that they should maybe take a class on second language acquisition, or how do you adapt instruction to facilitate language acquisition. I know that at Mizzou, weren't you have one?
Added one. Yeah, several years ago now, we added a course for all the prospective teachers.
But I think, like, that's one thing we could do. More broadly in teacher preparation.
I agree. I also wish that more people that we talked across areas. And I think, again, I've mentioned Judy a bunch of times. Hopefully she listens to this. Hi, Judy. But she does a good job with collaborating with language acquisition folks. Catherine Cheval did it with Rachel Pinno. I think it's hard to understand how the content, how to really put it in practice if you don't have both expertise at the table. And so I agree. And I hope that they continue to work together in these cross-discipline collaborations are necessary. I can't possibly know all the language acquisition literature. So when we collaborate with other people that do know those works, that's even better. And then we can start to build things together too.
Thank you so much for your analysis and your and sharing your thoughts here. I've been speaking with Zandra DiRaggio at the University of Florida now and Aaron Smith at Southern Mississippi. I do have a final question. And Aaron has helped out on the podcast before, but she's never been in this guest chair to answer this. Zandra has answered it, but I've told her she can have an opportunity to revise her answer if she wants. Because I don't know if you remember, Zandra, but so the question is about if you weren't in math education, what might you do as an alternative career? And a few years ago, Zandra said she would get a bicycle cart and she would sell bread and flowers. And I'm curious if that still would be the answer now that she's moved to Florida. And then Aaron, I don't think I've ever heard your answer to this one. So
back in Florida, which I love Missouri. It was absolutely the right place to start my career. And I miss my colleagues and my friends there a great deal. It was a wonderful place to work and be. So being in Florida, a bicycle cart is a little hotter proposition. I need an umbrella on it now. And also growing flowers in Florida is a lot tougher than in Missouri. Missouri dirt, you can just put anything in the ground and you look like a great gardener. Florida is a different beast. It is sand. There are all kinds of pests everywhere. I planted collard greens. They look terrible. So the bread, yes. Flowers, maybe not. We need to broaden it to other plants also, because I wouldn't make a lot of money currently until I figure out how to garden in Florida, because it is wild over here.
It's probably similar to gardening here. We might be in nearly the same zone. I have gone, you know, thought about a lot of different things if I wasn't in math education. I think of late, I might be a park ranger and like get to spend time outdoors and just appreciating nature and being within it and helping to preserve it for the future.
Yeah, that answer has been shared, I think, a couple times over the years on the podcast. And my younger brothers both worked as park, you know, folks at a sort of a state park in northern Michigan. But oh, then there's cool. The big national parks and, you know, lots of different settings that you could do that in.
You need to like analyze answers pre and post pandemic and see if people like started changing. They're like anything that's not technology and Zoom.
Yes, I want to be outside away from a screen.
I think I could also analyze like during the different time of the year, how quickly they have their answer. Like, so if they're like really burned out at the end of a semester, they're like, I know exactly what I would want to do.
They just look at their like LinkedIn site right here in their Indeed search and they're like, oh yeah, that job.
All right. Well, Zandra and Aaron, it's been great catching up with you and congrats again on the article.
Thanks. It was a long time coming.
I could tell, but as you had to conjure up some